This is Audible.
Blackstone Audiobooks presents Animal Farm by George Orwell. Introduction. In the sixth volume of the Second World War, Sir Winston Churchill has described the scene at Potsdam in July 1945, when, from a little distance, he watched President Truman tell Marshal Stalin of the great event that was to take place in the following month, the latest triumph of Western genius, the masterpiece that was destined so profoundly to affect the history of the world. The Marshal showed polite interest, the mildest of curiosity that barely rose above the level of indifference, and no comprehension whatever. Sir Winston was sure, he tells us, that he had no idea of the significance of what he was being told. If he had had the slightest idea of the revolution in world affairs which was in progress, his reactions would have been obvious, but his face remained gay and genial. According to President Truman, he did not even ask a single question. What Marshal Stalin was being told about was not, though as a matter of mere chronological chance it could have been, the imminent publication of a little book called Animal Farm, which appeared on the bookstalls in the same month in which the atomic bomb hit Hiroshima and Nagasaki. No doubt the Marshal's reaction would have been much the same if it had been, and perhaps, though this is still a very much longer shot, his reaction would have been just as inappropriate. It was nothing but an arbitrary coincidence that brought these two events together in August 1945, though they took almost equally long to prepare. George Orwell's whole life was spent in preparation of Animal Farm, and the text itself bears the dates November 1943, February 1944, months when the Manhattan Project was also moving towards a climax. But it was a coincidence that must have given Orwell a sad, ironic satisfaction. For there are those who have argued that, looked at in a wider historical context, the first atomic bombs were aimed at a quite different political target which had nothing to do with the Japanese war. And there are others who have convinced themselves that Animal Farm was also aimed at a political target, the same one. Orwell himself might perhaps have admitted to agreeing with both interpretations, but he would also surely have argued that this personal enemy was no single individual or government. It was the system of the world capable of producing and using atomic bombs. In this case, the coincidence of August 1945 was even more remarkable. Disciples of Professor Toynbee, yet unborn, may well point to it as one of history's most striking conjunctions of challenge and response. These are early days to claim that the pen is mightier than the atomic bomb, but Orwell would not have flinched from the confrontation. It is not much more than 100 years since Bulwer Lytton discovered for us that the pen is mightier than the sword, already then an obsolescent weapon, and even that only beneath the rule of men entirely great, a sufficiently rare state of affairs. In the last 100 years enough has happened to justify us in believing that the pen's response to the challenge of force is at least not ludicrous and hopeless. Indeed, it is perhaps the one serious hope we have. Certainly it would not have seemed ludicrous to Sir Winston Churchill to have spoken in the context of 1945 of a book instead of a bomb, for the pen has always been the first weapon in his armoury, and with it he won the most crucial victory in the history of our race, in the battle that was joined with the words, "We shall defend our island whatever the cost may be." Sir Winston had the advantage, it is true, though it is also true that he furnished that advantage himself, of proving Bulwer's epigram in the exact conditions required by Bulwer's qualifying line. George Orwell had come to doubt before he died, at any rate when he wrote 1984, whether those conditions would ever be seen on Earth again. But there is no doubt whatever that it was a purpose of the same kind that Orwell was setting himself to achieve by his writings, and especially when he wrote Animal Farm. If the book itself had left any doubt of the matter, Orwell dispelled it in an article which he called Why I Write, a few years later. Every line of serious work that I have written since 1936 has been written, directly or indirectly, against totalitarianism. Animal Farm was the first book in which I tried, with full consciousness of what I was doing, to fuse political purpose and artistic purpose into one whole. In the criticisms of some of his contemporaries, which Orwell wrote even earlier than Animal Farm, his recurrent theme was their failure to protest against the world they lived in. This is the whole burden of his longest and most serious piece of literary criticism, written in 1940 on Henry Miller, and he called it Inside the Whale, to illustrate this same point that Miller had failed in his duty to protest, had performed the essential Jonah act of allowing himself to be swallowed, remaining passive, accepting. In the same essay, he criticized a line of Mr. Auden's poem, Spain. The conscious acceptance of guilt in the necessary murder, with the comment that it could only be written by a person to whom murder is at most a word. Personally, I would not speak so lightly of murder. It is odd, then, to find that in Animal Farm he does speak just so lightly of murder, that in fact he places on record a score of murders without a measurable flicker of emotion in excess of Mr. Auden's. It is odder still, at first sight, to find Animal Farm subtitled A Fairy Story, for we are accustomed to think of the fairy story as the escapist form of literature par excellence. In what sense can Animal Farm properly be called a fairy story? It tells how the animals captured the manor farm from its drunken, incompetent farmer, how they changed its name to Animal Farm and established it as a model community in which all animals were equal, how two pigs, Napoleon and Snowball, gained control of the revolution and fought each other for the mastery, how the neighboring humans reacted and counterattacked and were beaten off, how Napoleon ousted Snowball and declared him a traitor, how economic necessity compelled the animals to compromise with the human system, how Napoleon negotiated an alliance with the human enemy and exploited it to establish his personal dictatorship, how the farm learned that some animals are more equal than others, and their last state was as bad as their first, and how the ruling pigs became daily more and more indistinguishable from their human neighbors. There is little here at first sight that we associate with the fairy story. There is no element of magic, once the initial convention of zoomorphism is accepted. There is no happy ending, except one for the villains. There is no prince charming, or maiden in distress, or sentimental interest of any kind, beyond the personal tragedy of the cart-horse boxer, and the frivolous vanity of the white mare Molly. The fairy story is an elastic category. Andrew Lang included A Voyage to Lilliput in the very first of his coloured fairy books. And certainly not all the conventional ingredients are essential to a fairy story. Yet it would be natural to suppose that at least some of them ought to be found there, and at first sight it is tempting to conclude that Orwell wrote his subtitle with his tongue in his cheek and to read Animal Farm with our tongues in ours. And then it is impossible to understand why the book has had such a worldwide appeal to human sentiment in the past 9 years, for books written in a mere spirit of teasing do not. In fact, Orwell was a deep lover of words who never consciously misused them. If he said he had written a fairy story with a political purpose, we cannot lightly suppose he spoke lightly. A political purpose suggests some kind of moral, and that suggests rather the fable, the medium of Aesop or La Fontaine or even Thurber. There have been fairy stories purporting to have morals before now. Rimsky-Korsakov called Le Coq d'Or a fairy tale with a moral, though no one, except possibly the Russian imperial censor, who objected to the original version of the opera as subversive, has ever been able to detect what it was. There is something freakish about the idea anyway, which makes it seem unlikely to stir the emotions of the common reader, and it is impossible to attach a moral in any familiar sense to Animal Farm, where wickedness ends in triumph and virtue is utterly crushed. There is perhaps a moral for farmers. Don't take to drink and let your animals get out of hand. But even so, the villains will be comforted to find that everything comes out all right for them in the end. For the downtrodden animals there is nothing but misery, cruelty, and injustice. And in place of a moral, there is only the tragic chorus of the donkey Benjamin, who held that life would go on as it had always gone on, that is, badly. This is not like the kind of moral that tells us to look before we leap, or not to count our boobies before they are hatched. For the animals never had a chance to choose, and if they had, it would have made no difference. It is just this sense of purposeless cruelty, though, that gives the clue to Orwell's purpose, as well as to his deadly serious reason for calling Animal Farm a fairy story. The point about fairy stories is that they are written not merely without a moral, but without a morality. They take place in a world beyond good and evil, where people or animals suffer or prosper for reasons unconnected with ethical merit, for being ugly or beautiful, respectively, for instance, or for even more unsatisfactory reasons. A little girl sets out to do a good deed for her grandmother and gets gobbled up by a wolf. A young rogue escapes the gallows and gets an old Jew hanged instead by his talent on the fiddle. Dozens of young princes die horrible deaths trying to get through the thorn hedge that surrounds the Sleeping Beauty, just because they had the bad luck to be born before her 100-year curse expired. And one young prince, no better or worse, no handsomer or uglier than the rest, gets through merely because he has the good luck to arrive just as the 100 years are up. And so on and so on. Even when Grimm's stepmothers are called wicked, it is well to remember that in German their Bosheit is viciousness and bad temper, not moral guilt. For all this is related by the fairy storytellers without approval or disapproval, without a glimmer of subjective feeling, as though their pens were dipped in surgical spirit to sterilize the microbes of emotion. They never seek to criticize or moralize, to protest or plead or persuade. And if they have an emotional impact on the reader, as the greatest of them do, that is not intrinsic to the stories. They would indeed only weaken that impact in direct proportion as soon as they set out to achieve it. They move by not seeking to move, almost, it seems, by seeking not to move. The fairy story that succeeds is, in fact, not a work of fiction at all, or at least no more so than, say, the opening chapters of Genesis. It is a transcription of a view of life into terms of highly simplified symbols, and when it succeeds in its literary purpose, it leaves us with a deep, indefinable feeling of truth. And if it succeeds also, as Orwell set out to do, in a political as well as an artistic purpose, it leaves us also with a feeling of rebelliousness against the truth revealed. It does so not by adjuring us to rebel, but by the barest economy of plain description that language can achieve. And lest it should be thought guilty of a deliberate appeal to the emotions, it uses for characters not rounded three-dimensional human beings that develop psychologically through time, but fixed stereotypes, puppets, silhouettes, or animals. A specially good instance is The Adventures of Pinocchio. For Pinocchio was, in fact, a wooden puppet. And when, at last, by acquiring a heart and a conscience, he became a little boy instead, at that exact point, with a sure instinct, Collodi brought the whole matter to a full stop, since he was writing a fairy tale and not a didactic children's romance. In these respects, Animal Farm is, after all, correctly labelled a fairy story. Its message, which is by no means a moral, is that of all the great fairy stories. Life is like that. Take it or leave it. And because it is written by a poet, a reaction is like that of another poet, Edna St. Vincent Millay, to another, not so very different, situation. I know, but I do not approve, and I am not resigned. To argue thus is to class Orwell among the poets, and that is not absurd. It happens that when he wrote in verse, the results were not particularly distinguished. The song in Animal Farm, Beasts of England, is not a fair example, since it was no more intended to be poetry than God Save the Queen. It is, in fact, a happy example of what Professor Collingwood, in his aesthetic theory, used to call magic art. But there are a few examples in Orwell's other works, in the posthumous collection of essays, England, Your England, for example, which do purport to be poetry, and as such fail. Orwell was a poet who happened to find his medium in prose, a poet not so much in his means of expression as in the nature of his vision, which could strip the sprawling tangle of the world around him down to its core with the simplicity of a timeless flash of intuition, the sort of intuition enjoyed by Dionysiacs, according to Plato, or by epileptics, according to Dostoevsky, or by devotees of mescaline, according to Mr. Aldous Huxley, and which then turned deliberately to the most aesthetically plain tools of expression to communicate it. He was the kind of prose writer whom poets accepted as one of themselves, as Shelley accepted Herodotus, Plato, Livy, Plutarch, Bacon, and Rousseau among the poets he was defending in A Defense of Poetry. and Shelley, who may be supposed to have known his business, would surely have been glad to accept a writer who so confidently supported and strove so stubbornly to substantiate his own claim that poets are the unacknowledged legislators of the world. Is the claim justified of Orwell? Clearly not yet, and even for the future only by offering precarious hostages to fortune. But everything has been a bit precarious since August 1945, when Animal Farm and its formidable twin first saw the light of day together. Which of the two has so far made the biggest impression? There is no blinding or deafening ourselves to that. But Orwell's still small voice has also made itself continuously heard in its own quiet, persistent, almost nagging way. Already there have been momentary intervals in the nuclear uproar of the mid-20th century when its steady, reassuring murmur has come through. Already in a score of countries and a dozen languages, Animal Farm has made its peculiar mark in translation and in strip cartoon, one of the most appropriate of modern vehicles for a fairy story. And the political flavour of its message, at least, whether rightly or wrongly particularised, has not been lost in the transcription. Already Orwell has launched the long haul of resting back some of those cardinal, once meaningful words like equality, peace, democracy, which have been fraudulently converted into shibboleths of political warfare. And already it is impossible for anyone who has read Animal Farm, as well as for many who have not, to listen to the demagogue's claptrap about equality without also hearing the still, small voice that adds, "But some are more equal than others." There is a long way to go yet, but there is a long time ahead, too. Animal Farm will not, like Uncle Tom's Cabin, contribute to changing history within a decade or so. But it probably has as good a chance as any contemporary work of winning its author a place, unacknowledged, of course, among Shelley's legislators of the world. And even if the chance does not come off, Orwell has anyway two strings to his bow. He is the author of 1984 as well as of Animal Farm. If the worst comes to the worst and he fails as a legislator, he is then virtually certain of immortality as a prophet. C. M. Woodhouse, The Times Literary Supplement, London, August 6, 1954. Chapter 1. Mr. Jones of the Manor Farm had locked the hen houses for the night, but was too drunk to remember to shut the popholes. With the ring of light from his lantern dancing from side to side, he lurched across the yard, kicked off his boots at the back door, drew himself a last glass of beer from the barrel in the scullery, and made his way up to bed, where Mrs. Jones was already snoring. As soon as the light in the bedroom went out, there was a stirring and a fluttering all through the farm buildings. Word had gone round during the day that old Major, the prize middle white boar, had had a strange dream on the previous night, and wished to communicate it to the other animals. It had been agreed that they should all meet in the big barn as soon as Mr. Jones was safely out of the way. Old Major, so he was always called, though the name under which he had been exhibited was Willingdon Beauty, was so highly regarded on the farm that everyone was quite ready to lose an hour's sleep in order to hear what he had to say. At one end of the big barn, on a sort of raised platform, Major was already ensconced on his bed of straw, under a lantern which hung from a beam. He was 12 years old, and had lately grown rather stout, but he was still a majestic-looking pig, with a wise and benevolent appearance, in spite of the fact that his tushes had never been cut. Before long, the other animals began to arrive and make themselves comfortable after their different fashions. First came the three dogs, Bluebell, Jessie, and Pincher, and then the pigs, who settled down in the straw immediately in front of the platform. The hens perched themselves on the window-sills, the pigeons fluttered up to the rafters, the sheep and cows lay down behind the pigs and began to chew the cud. The two cart-horses, Boxer and Clover, came in together, walking very slowly and setting down their vast hairy hoofs with great care, lest there should be some small animal concealed in the straw. Clover was a stout motherly mare approaching middle life, who had never quite got her figure back after her fourth foal. Boxer was an enormous beast, nearly 18 hands high, and as strong as any two ordinary horses put together. A white stripe down his nose gave him a somewhat stupid appearance, and in fact he was not of first-rate intelligence. But he was universally respected for his steadiness of character and tremendous powers of work. After the horses came Muriel, the white goat, and Benjamin, the donkey. Benjamin was the oldest animal on the farm and the worst-tempered. He seldom talked, and when he did, it was usually to make some cynical remark. For instance, he would say that God had given him a tail to keep the flies off, but that he would sooner have had no tail and no flies. Alone among the animals on the farm, he never laughed. If asked why, he would say that he saw nothing to laugh at. Nevertheless, without openly admitting it, he was devoted to Boxer. The two of them usually spent their Sundays together in the small paddock beyond the orchard, grazing side by side and never speaking. The two horses had just lain down when a brood of ducklings, which had lost their mother, filed into the barn, cheeping feebly and wandering from side to side to find some place where they would not be trodden on. Clover made a sort of wall round them with her great foreleg, and the ducklings nestled down inside it and promptly fell asleep. At the last moment, Molly, the foolish, pretty white mare who drew Mr. Jones's trap, came mincing daintily in, chewing at a lump of sugar. She took a place near the front and began flirting her white mane, hoping to draw attention to the red ribbons it was plaited with. Last of all came the cat, who looked round, as usual, for the warmest place, and finally squeezed herself in between Boxer and Clover. There she purred contentedly throughout Major's speech, without listening to a word of what he was saying. All the animals were now present except Moses, the tame raven, who slept on a perch behind the back door. When Major saw that they had all made themselves comfortable and were waiting attentively, he cleared his throat and began.
"Comrades, you have heard already about the strange dream that I had last night, but I will come to the dream later. I have something else to say first. I do not think, comrades, that I shall be with you for many months longer, and before I die, I feel it my duty to pass on to you such wisdom as I have acquired. I have had a long life. I have had much time for thought as I lay alone in my stall, and I think I may say that I understand the nature of life on this earth as well as any animal now living. It is about this that I wish to speak to you. Now, comrades, what is the nature of this life of ours? Let us face it. Our lives are miserable, laborious, and short. We are born, we are given just so much food as will keep the breath in our bodies, and those of us who are capable of it are forced to work to the last atom of our strength, and the very instant that our usefulness has come to an end, we are slaughtered with hideous cruelty. No animal in England knows the meaning of happiness or leisure after he is a year old. No animal in England is free. The life of an animal is misery and slavery. That is the plain truth. But is this simply part of the order of nature? Is it because this land of ours is so poor that it cannot afford a decent life to those who dwell upon it?
No, comrades. 1,000 times no.
The soil of England is fertile. Its climate is good. It is capable of affording food in abundance to an enormously greater number of animals than now inhabit it. This single farm of ours would support 12 horses, 20 cows, hundreds of sheep, and all of them living in a comfort and a dignity that are now almost beyond our imagining. Why, then, do we continue in this miserable condition? Because nearly the whole of the produce of our labour is stolen from us by human beings. There, comrades, is the answer to all our problems. It is summed up in a single word. Man. Man is the only real enemy we have. Remove man from the scene and the root cause of hunger and overwork is abolished forever. Man is the only creature that consumes without producing. He does not give milk. He does not lay eggs. He is too weak to pull the plough. He cannot run fast enough to catch rabbits. Yet he is lord of all the animals. He sets them to work. He gives back to them the bare minimum that will prevent them from starving, and the rest he keeps for himself. Our labour tills the soil. Our dung fertilizes it. And yet there is not one of us that owns more than his bare skin. You cows that I see before me, how many thousands of gallons of milk have you given during this last year? And what has happened to that milk, which should have been breeding up sturdy calves? Every drop of it has gone down the throats of our enemies. And you hens, how many eggs have you laid in this last year, and how many of those eggs ever hatched into chickens? The rest have all gone to market to bring in money for Jones and his men. And you, Clover, where are those 4 foals you bore, who should have been the support and pleasure of your old age? Each was sold at 1 year old. You will never see one of them again. In return for your four confinements and all your labour in the fields, what have you ever had except your bare rations and a stall? And even the miserable lives we lead are not allowed to reach their natural span. For myself, I do not grumble, for I am one of the lucky ones. I am 12 years old and have had over 400 children. Such is the natural life of a pig. But no animal escapes the cruel knife in the end. You young porkers who are sitting in front of me, every one of you will scream your lives out of the block within a year. To that horror we all must come, cows, pigs, hens, sheep, everyone. Even the horses and the dogs have no better fate. You, Boxer, the very day that those great muscles of yours lose their power, Jones will sell you to the knacker, who will cut your throat and boil you down for the foxhounds. As for the dogs, when they grow old and toothless, Jones ties a brick round their necks and drowns them in the nearest pond. Is it not crystal clear, then, comrades, that all the evils of this life of ours spring from the tyranny of human beings? Only get rid of man, and the produce of our labour would be our own. Almost overnight we could become rich and free. What, then, must we do? Why, work night and day, body and soul, for the overthrow of the human race. That is my message to you, comrades. Rebellion. I do not know when that rebellion will come. It might be in a week or in 100 years, but I know, as surely as I see this straw beneath my feet, that sooner or later justice will be done. Fix your eyes on that, comrades, throughout the short remainder of your lives. And above all, pass on this message of mine to those who come after you, so that future generations shall carry on the struggle until it is victorious. And remember, comrades, your resolution must never falter. No argument must lead you astray. Never listen when they tell you that man and the animals have a common interest, that the prosperity of the one is the prosperity of the others. It is all lies. Man serves the interests of no creature except himself. And among us animals, let there be perfect unity, perfect comradeship in the struggle. All men are enemies. All animals are comrades. At this moment there was a tremendous uproar. While Major was speaking, four large rats had crept out of their holes and were sitting on their hindquarters listening to him. The dogs had suddenly caught sight of them, and it was only by a swift dash for their holes that the rats saved their lives. Major raised his trotter for silence. "Comrades," he said, "here is a point that must be settled. The wild creatures, such as rats and rabbits, are they our friends or our enemies? Let us put it to the vote. I propose this question to the meeting. Are rats comrades?" The vote was taken at once, and it was agreed by an overwhelming majority that the rats were comrades. There were only four dissentients, the three dogs and the cat, who was afterwards discovered to have voted on both sides. Major continued, "I have little more to say. I merely repeat, remember always your duty of enmity towards man and all his ways. Whatever goes upon two legs is an enemy. Whatever goes upon four legs or has wings is a friend. And remember also that in fighting against man, we must not come to resemble him. Even when you have conquered him, do not adopt his vices. No animal must ever live in a house, or sleep in a bed, or wear clothes, or drink alcohol, or smoke tobacco, or touch money, or engage in trade. All the habits of man are evil, and above all, no animal must ever tyrannize over his own kind. Weak or strong, clever or simple, we are all brothers. No animal must ever kill any other animal. All animals are equal. And now, comrades, I will tell you about my dream of last night. I cannot describe that dream to you. It was a dream of the earth as it will be when man has vanished. But it reminded me of something that I had long forgotten. Many years ago, when I was a little pig, my mother and the other sows used to sing an old song of which they knew only the tune and the first three words. I had known that tune in my infancy, but it had long since passed out of my mind. Last night, however, it came back to me in my dream, and, what is more, the words of the song also came back. Words, I am certain, which were sung by the animals of long ago and have been lost to memory for generations. I will sing you that song now, comrades. I am old, and my voice is hoarse, But when I have taught you the tune, you can sing it better for yourselves. It is called Beasts of England.
Old Major cleared his throat and began to sing. As he had said, his voice was hoarse, but he sang well enough, and it was a stirring tune, something between Clementine and La Cucaracha. The words ran,
Beasts of England, beasts of Ireland, beasts of every land and clime, hearken to my joyful tidings of the golden future time. Soon or late the day is coming, tyrant man shall be o'erthrown, and the fruitful fields of England shall be trod by beasts alone. Rings shall vanish from our noses, and the harness from our back. Bit and spur shall rust for ever, cruel whips no more shall crack. Riches more than mind can picture, wheat and barley, oats and hay, clover beans and mangel wurzels shall be ours upon that day. Bright will shine the fields of England, purer shall its waters be, sweeter yet shall blow its breezes on the day that sets us free. For that day we all must labour, though we die before it break. Cows and horses, geese and turkeys, all must toil for freedom's sake. Beasts of England, beasts of Ireland, beasts of every land and clime, hearken well and spread my tidings of the golden future time.
The singing of this song threw the animals into the wildest excitement. Almost before Major had reached the end, they had begun singing it for themselves. Even the stupidest of them had already picked up the tune and a few of the words, and as for the clever ones, such as the pigs and dogs, they had the entire song by heart within a few minutes. And then, after a few preliminary tries, the whole farm burst out into Beasts of England in tremendous unison. The cows lowed it, the dogs whined it, the sheep bleated it, the horses whinnied it, the ducks quacked it. They were so delighted with the song that they sang it right through 5 times in succession, and might have continued singing it all night if they had not been interrupted. Unfortunately, the uproar awoke Mr. Jones, who sprang out of bed, making sure that there was a fox in the yard. He seized the gun which always stood in a corner of his bedroom, and let fly a charge of No. 6 shot into the darkness. The pellets buried themselves in the wall of the barn, and the meeting broke up hurriedly. Everyone fled to his own sleeping place. The birds jumped onto their perches, the animals settled down in the straw, and the whole farm was asleep in a moment.
Chapter 2 3 nights later, old Major died peacefully in his sleep. His body was buried at the foot of the orchard. This was early in March. During the next 3 months there was much secret activity. Major's speech had given to the more intelligent animals on the farm a completely new outlook on life. They did not know when the rebellion predicted by Major would take place. They had no reason for thinking that it would be within their own lifetime, but they saw clearly that it was their duty to prepare for it. The work of teaching and organizing the others fell naturally upon the pigs, who were generally recognized as being the cleverest of the animals. Preeminent among the pigs were 2 young boars named Snowball and Napoleon, whom Mr. Jones was breeding up for sale. Napoleon was a large, rather fierce-looking Berkshire boar, the only Berkshire on the farm, not much of a talker, but with a reputation for getting his own way. Snowball was a more vivacious pig than Napoleon, quicker in speech and more inventive, but was not considered to have the same depth of character. All the other male pigs on the farm were porkers. The best known among them was a small, fat pig named Squealer, with very round cheeks, twinkling eyes, nimble movements, and a shrill voice. He was a brilliant talker, and when he was arguing some difficult point, he had a way of skipping from side to side and whisking his tail, which was somehow very persuasive. The others said of Squealer that he could turn black into white. These 3 had elaborated old Major's teaching into a complete system of thought, to which they gave the name of animalism. Several nights a week, after Mr. Jones was asleep, they held secret meetings in the barn and expounded the principles of animalism to the others. At the beginning they met with much stupidity and apathy. Some of the animals talked of the duty of loyalty to Mr. Jones, whom they referred to as Master, or made elementary remarks such as, "Mr. Jones feeds us. If he were gone, we should starve to death." Others asked such questions as, "Why should we care what happens after we are dead?" Or, "If this rebellion is to happen anyway, what difference does it make whether we work for it or not?" And the pigs had great difficulty in making them see that this was contrary to the spirit of animalism. The stupidest questions of all were asked by Molly, the white mare. The very first question she asked Snowball was,
"Will there still be sugar after the rebellion?"
"No," said Snowball firmly. "We have no means of making sugar on this farm. Besides, you do not need sugar. You will have all the oats and hay you want."
"And shall I still be allowed to wear ribbons in my mane?" asked Molly.
"Comrade," said Snowball, "those ribbons that you are so devoted to are the badge of slavery. Can you not understand that liberty is worth more than ribbons?" Molly agreed, but she did not sound very convinced. The pigs had an even harder struggle to counteract the lies put about by Moses, the tame raven. Moses, who was Mr. Jones's especial pet, was a spy and a tale-bearer, but he was also a clever talker. He claimed to know of the existence of a mysterious country called Sugar Candy Mountain, to which all animals went when they died. It was situated somewhere up in the sky, a little distance beyond the clouds, Moses said. In Sugar Candy Mountain it was Sunday 7 days a week, clover was in season all the year round, and lump sugar and linseed cake grew on the hedges. The animals hated Moses because he told tales and did no work, but some of them believed in Sugar Candy Mountain, and the pigs had to argue very hard to persuade them that there was no such place. Their most faithful disciples were the two cart horses, Boxer and Clover. These two had great difficulty in thinking anything out for themselves, but having once accepted the pigs as their teachers, they absorbed everything that they were told and passed it on to the other animals by simple arguments. They were unfailing in their attendance at the secret meetings in the barn, and led the singing of Beasts of England, with which the meetings always ended. Now, as it turned out, the rebellion was achieved much earlier and more easily than anyone had expected. In past years, Mr. Jones, although a hard master, had been a capable farmer. But of late he had fallen on evil days. He had become much disheartened after losing money in a lawsuit, and had taken to drinking more than was good for him. For whole days at a time he would lounge in his Windsor chair in the kitchen, reading the newspapers, drinking, and occasionally feeding Moses on crusts of bread soaked in beer. His men were idle and dishonest, the fields were full of weeds, the buildings wanted roofing, the hedges were neglected, and the animals were underfed. June came, and the hay was almost ready for cutting. On Midsummer's Eve, which was a Saturday, Mr. Jones went into Willingdon and got so drunk at the Red Lion that he did not come back till midday on Sunday. The men had milked the cows in the early morning, and then had gone out rabbiting without bothering to feed the animals. When Mr. Jones got back, he immediately went to sleep on the drawing-room sofa with the news of the world over his face, so that when evening came the animals were still unfed. At last they could stand it no longer. One of the cows broke in the door of the store-shed with her horn, and all the animals began to help themselves from the bins. It was just then that Mr. Jones woke up. The next moment he and his four men were in the store-shed with whips in their hands, lashing out in all directions. This was more than the hungry animals could bear. With one accord, though nothing of the kind had been planned beforehand, they flung themselves upon their tormentors. Jones and his men suddenly found themselves being butted and kicked from all sides. The situation was quite out of their control. They had never seen animals behave like this before, and this sudden uprising of creatures whom they were used to thrashing and maltreating just as they chose frightened them almost out of their wits. After only a moment or two they gave up trying to defend themselves and took to their heels. A minute later, all five of them were in full flight down the cart track that led to the main road, with the animals pursuing them in triumph. Mrs. Jones looked out of the bedroom window, saw what was happening, hurriedly flung a few possessions into a carpet bag, and slipped out of the farm by another way. Moses sprang off his perch and flapped after her, croaking loudly. Meanwhile, the animals had chased Jones and his men out onto the road and slammed the five-barred gate behind them. And so, almost before they knew what was happening, the rebellion had been successfully carried through. Jones was expelled, and the manor farm was theirs. For the first few minutes, the animals could hardly believe in their good fortune. Their first act was to gallop in a body right round the boundaries of the farm, as though to make quite sure that no human being was hiding anywhere upon it. Then they raced back to the farm buildings to wipe out the last traces of Jones's hated reign. The harness room at the end of the stables was broken open. The bits, the nose rings, the dog chains, the cruel knives with which Mr. Jones had been used to castrate the pigs and lambs were all flung down the well. The reins, the halters, the blinkers, the degrading nose bags were thrown onto the rubbish fire which was burning in the yard. So were the whips. All the animals capered with joy when they saw the whips going up in flames. Snowball also threw onto the fire the ribbons with which the horses' manes and tails had usually been decorated on market days. "Ribbons," he said, "should be considered as clothes, which are the mark of a human being. All animals should go naked." When Boxer heard this, he fetched the small straw hat which he wore in summer to keep the flies out of his ears, and flung it onto the fire with the rest. In a very little while the animals had destroyed everything that reminded them of Mr. Jones. Napoleon then led them back to the store shed and served out a double ration of corn to everybody, with two biscuits for each dog. Then they sang Beasts of England from end to end 7 times running, and after that they settled down for the night and slept as they had never slept before. But they woke at dawn, as usual, and suddenly remembering the glorious thing that had happened, they all raced out into the pasture together. A little way down the pasture there was a knoll that commanded a view of most of the farm. The animals rushed to the top of it and gazed round them in the clear morning light. Yes, it was theirs. Everything that they could see was theirs. In the ecstasy of that thought, they gambolled round and round. They hurled themselves into the air in great leaps of excitement. They rolled in the dew. They cropped mouthfuls of the sweet summer grass. They kicked up clods of the black earth and snuffed its rich scent. Then they made a tour of inspection of the whole farm and surveyed with speechless admiration the ploughland, the hayfield, the orchard, the pool, the spinney. It was as though they had never seen these things before, and even now they could hardly believe that it was all their own. Then they filed back to the farm buildings and halted in silence outside the door of the farmhouse. That was theirs, too, but they were frightened to go inside. After a moment, however, Snowball and Napoleon butted the door open with their shoulders, and the animals entered in single file, walking with the utmost care for fear of disturbing anything. They tiptoed from room to room, afraid to speak above a whisper, and gazing with a kind of awe at the unbelievable luxury, at the beds with their feather mattresses, the looking-glasses, the horsehair sofa, the Brussels carpet, the lithograph of Queen Victoria over the drawing-room mantelpiece. They were just coming down the stairs when Molly was discovered to be missing. Going back, the others found that she had remained behind in the best bedroom. She had taken a piece of blue ribbon from Mrs. Jones's dressing-table and was holding it against her shoulder and admiring herself in the glass in a very foolish manner. The others reproached her sharply, and they went outside. Some hams hanging in the kitchen were taken out for burial, and the barrel of beer in the scullery was stove in with a kick from Boxer's hoof. Otherwise nothing in the house was touched. A unanimous resolution was passed on the spot that the farmhouse should be preserved as a museum. All were agreed that no animal must ever live there. The animals had their breakfast, and then Snowball and Napoleon called them together again. "Comrades," said Snowball, "it is 6:30, and we have a long day before us. Today we begin the hay harvest, but there is another matter that must be attended to first." The pigs now revealed that during the past 3 months they had taught themselves to read and write from an old spelling book which had belonged to Mr. Jones's children and which had been thrown on the rubbish heap. Napoleon sent for pots of black and white paint and led the way down to the five-barred gate that gave on to the main road. Then Snowball, for it was Snowball who was best at writing, took a brush between the two knuckles of his trotter, painted out Manor Farm from the top bar of the gate, and in its place painted Animal Farm. This was to be the name of the farm from now onwards. After this, they went back to the farm buildings, where Snowball and Napoleon sent for a ladder, which they caused to be set against the end wall of the big barn. They explained that by their studies of the past 3 months, the pigs had succeeded in reducing the principles of animalism to 7 commandments. These 7 commandments would now be inscribed on the wall. They would form an unalterable law by which all the animals on Animal Farm must live forever after. With some difficulty, for it is not easy for a pig to balance himself on a ladder, Snowball climbed up and set to work, with Squealer a few rungs below him holding the paint pot. The commandments were written on the tarred wall in great white letters that could be read 30 yards away. They ran thus. The 7 commandments. 1. Whatever goes upon 2 legs is an enemy. 2. Whatever goes upon 4 legs or has wings is a friend. 3. No animal shall wear clothes. 4. No animal shall sleep in a bed. 5. No animal shall drink alcohol. 6. No animal shall kill any other animal. 7. All animals are equal. It was very neatly written, and except that friend was written F-R-E-I-N-D, and one of the S's was the wrong way round, the spelling was correct all the way through. Snowball read it aloud for the benefit of the others. All the animals nodded in complete agreement, and the cleverer ones at once began to learn the commandments by heart. "Now, comrades," cried Snowball, throwing down the paintbrush, "to the hayfield. Let us make it a point of honour to get in the harvest more quickly than Jones and his men could do." But at this moment the 3 cows, who had seemed uneasy for some time past, set up a loud lowing. They had not been milked for 24 hours, and their udders were almost bursting. After a little thought, the pigs sent for buckets and milked the cows fairly successfully, their trotters being well adapted to this task. Soon there were 5 buckets of frothing, creamy milk, at which many of the animals looked with considerable interest.
"What is going to happen to all that milk?"
said someone.
"Jones used sometimes to mix some of it in our mash,"
said one of the hens.
"Never mind the milk, comrades," cried Napoleon, placing himself in front of the buckets. "That will be attended to. The harvest is more important. Comrade Snowball will lead the way. I shall follow in a few minutes. Forward, comrades. The hay is waiting."
So the animals trooped down to the hayfield to begin the harvest, and when they came back in the evening, it was noticed that the milk had disappeared. Chapter 3. How they toiled and sweated to get the hay in, but their effort